LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
It was a huge week at the Supreme Court, Bitcoins and Aliens as advertised, and more on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising with Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
In high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage, and I can see through these guys.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. I am your host, Scott Cosenza, and it is a huge week at the Supreme Court. We've got a report on Bitcoin for you and a follow-on from the Andrew Brown Jr. shooting investigation. The tapes are out, or at least a tape is out. All right. First up, let's talk about Larry Krasner. Just a brief update. He was successful in winning re-election as district attorney for Philadelphia. Krasner, you'll recall, was the first, or one of the very first, of the Soros DAs around the country. George Soros spent many, many millions of dollars installing these DAs. I think he gave Krasner 1.5 or 7 all-in millions of dollars for his first run. I don't think we'll know until all the election reporting is out to find out what kind of largesse he gave him to stay in office. But Philadelphia has been beset by a huge increase in homicides. I think it's over a 25% increase in homicides over the past couple of years during Krasner's term. And the question is, would the people come out and reject his notion of progressive prosecutorial disposition for a more traditional law and order, which is what they had in Philadelphia for the last couple of generations? And they said no. It was an off-year election, so there weren't other elections to choose from. People were pretty much going to the polls for some ballot initiative or referenda questions and this DA race. And I think it was better than 6 in 10 that voted for Krasner. So there is a huge amount of news from the Supreme Court on abortion and the Fourth Amendment that came down this week. In the case of the Fourth Amendment, that was in the form of a decision that declined to increase police officers' discretion in when they can search without a warrant. So there's a longstanding rule that police officers could search a car that they had already impounded due to their community caretaking function. So basically what happened was, a long time ago, there was this case where a guy who was a cop who was off duty, he left his car at a mechanic's lot, and the police had impounded the car for some reason, and he wasn't able to retrieve his firearm. And so a cop with a good head on his shoulders went over and basically secured the gun. And looking for the gun, he found evidence of another crime, which is why we know about the case, because there was a suppression hearing held and it went to the Supreme Court. We don't need to focus on that part of it, because that can just confuse the issue. The issue is, was that initial search legal? And the idea was just the cop was trying to secure the gun so a mechanic or some other third party didn't happen upon a firearm. And the Supreme Court in that case said, well, the car was already in police custody, which is to say it was impounded. And the search for the firearm wasn't about any kind of criminal justice issue. It was about part of this other thing that police do, especially with respect to cars, which is this community caretaking function. Cars abandoned on the side of the road, what happens to it? That's a police matter in most places, or at least the police are in charge of supervising it if it's a highway department wrecker that comes to pick it up, or somebody the city or other government agency has contracted with. So a court tried in Rhode Island, tried to apply that to the home. A man in Rhode Island had spoken to his wife, and he gave her reason to think that he was suicidal. Her belief seemed genuine, and she called the police to basically make sure that he didn't commit suicide, maybe take him away to a mental hospital or who knows what. They arrive and find the man on his front porch. He tells the police that he's not suicidal. And he will, however, go with them. He will submit to their request that he undergo a psychiatric evaluation at a mental health facility. He goes with them in an ambulance. But before he leaves, he says, the only way I'll go with you is if you promise that you won't take my guns. They promise, and they take him away in the ambulance. Then when he leaves, the police convince his wife. They lie to her and convince her that he wanted the police to take his guns, or at least was going to allow that to happen. So she leads them to a couple of pistols that he has, and they seize them. Well, is it a theft, or is it some sort of community caretaking function? That's what the case is about. The district court ruled that it was consistent with a community caretaking function, that without a warrant, they didn't need to, because of this precedent that existed with respect to the cars. Also, the Court of Appeals agreed that this was a new exception to the warrant requirement. So how it works is our Fourth Amendment says that you can't unreasonably search or seize something, and that those searches or seizures should be accompanied by a warrant. It's one of the reasons why we broke away from the Crown, was searches without a warrant. Now, there are some exceptions to that rule. Hot pursuit, for instance, is one. A guy robs a liquor store and runs across the street into his own house. A cop doesn't have to wait to get a warrant to go in and get him. If they saw this happen, they can just run right in. Also, if a police officer reasonably believes that the suspect is stealing evidence, if they knock on Bernie Madoff's door with their warrant and he's in there through the window gleefully shredding documents, or rather what I meant was with an arrest warrant, not a search warrant, they could go in. Or if they thought somebody was being tortured or maimed, they need not wait for a warrant. So those are the exceptions to a warrant requirement, and also consent, which is perhaps the most common exception to the warrant requirement. We see, if you watch a lot of these cop videos, and in fact, the show Cops used to feature this all the time, they would have people on and police officers would try to convince the people to let them search their whether house, car, whatever. And the reason why is because if you do consent to a search, then you can't object to it later under any legal grounds if it was a lawful consent, which is why you should never, ever, by the way, consent to a search. It doesn't matter if you've done anything wrong or not. It's just a bad idea to have the police rummaging around in your stuff. So those are the exceptions to the warrant requirement, but police didn't proceed under any of those exceptions in this Rhode Island case. They tried to exploit this as a new exception. And the appeals court agreed with the lower court again, which said it was a new exception to the warrant requirement. And thankfully, the United States Supreme Court unanimously disagreed with those lower courts and said, absolutely not. There is no exception, no new exception to the warrant requirement. They declined the invitation of these lower courts to open up this new way police can seize things without permission or without oversight. So I think it's a great win for the Fourth Amendment and for liberty, and also that all the justices agreed. This was a unanimous verdict. Clarence Thomas wrote the opinion for the court. There were several other justices who kind of wrote to make sure that no one was misunderstanding their opinion to believe that police could never do such a thing. And I think it was Justice Kavanaugh who wrote that this doesn't address, he explicitly wrote to say this doesn't address red flag issues, red flag laws, and that they may come up before the court in the future. So in any case, I think it's an excellent Fourth Amendment decision. The other big news from the Supreme Court this week is that they are going to take a major abortion case in their next term. What part of what makes it a major case is the breadth of the question that's presented. Mississippi has a law that says that it's illegal to get an abortion, a surgical abortion, after 15 weeks, unless there are some very few exceptions, life of the mother, a crime's been committed, that sort of thing. So basically a ban of abortions after 15 weeks, which is not something the courts have ever allowed, not something that the federal courts have ever allowed since Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood cases, because it's before viability, the time when a fetus can live outside the womb. The reason why it's such a huge moment for abortion law is the supposition by all of us court watchers that the reason why they have taken the case and the question that it was presented with is that enough justices want to change the law or write a different opinion that would allow this sort of restriction pre-viability. It's a sea change, if so, to abortion law. Four justices must agree to hear a case at the Supreme Court before they get permission to argue there. So we now have at least four justices who think this is a case they should take. And there's only one reason that sort of makes sense to those of us who watch the court, which is that they want to take it because they want to change the rule. Because if they didn't want to change the rule, they would just articulate that they could either do two things, which is to not take the case, let the lower court ruling stand, which tossed out the Mississippi law, or they could just rule unanimously from the bench, which they've done sort of like a per curiam opinion that this restriction is disallowed because it comes before viability. But they haven't done it. Everybody is thinking that both, you know, for the anti-abortion side, they're delighted because they think this could mean an end to abortion. And for the folks that favor legal access to abortion, they are panicking and going crazy because they think this could mean the end of it. And they're both right. So we will certainly keep an eye on it in the pages of LibertyNation.com and, of course, here at the Uprising. All right, let's talk about Andrew Brown for just a few minutes. He's the fellow in Pascatank County, North Carolina, near Elizabeth City, Elizabeth City in Pascatank County. And Mr. Crump has been making a lot of hay about this case for weeks because the way it works in North Carolina with evidence is they don't release the body cam stuff very quickly, lest it be used for inflammatory purposes. Well, we can agree or disagree with that, but one thing we can agree on is that officers thought they were going to be run over by Mr. Brown, and that's why they shot him. But that's not the narrative was played out. And I just want to take a minute to talk about this because Ben Crump has tweeted about how police mislead the public with respect to the lives of police victims of violence. He says, step one, the officer kills a person of color victim, and then the press releases, the police department releases an official report presenting a false narrative to justify the shooting. And then step three is initial news stories repeat the police report, framing the cop as the hero and the victim as a villain. And I think he's right about that, that is something that police officers do. As a matter of fact, we talked about the Philadelphia police and Larry Krasner's reign. And I think I've seen that done with the Philadelphia police years previously. So I know that does happen. But also Ben Crump, instead of just working against that, he's adopted that as a model for his own business practices. Ben Crump whips up the sort of cauldron of racial justice and then does the exact same thing, except for killing the person, obviously. But he releases his sort of official report presenting a false narrative to justify the shooting and then actually engages with sort of press agents to push that story out. We learned that first with at least it was publicly revealed first with Ryan Julison was the media man he used to push the Trayvon Martin story. And what I mean by push it in a way that is deceptive is, for instance, getting out the pictures that we all know and see from Trayvon from being not his 17-year-old, 6-foot-tall self that likes to fight, but of the little kid, of the 10-year-old Trayvon with his toy in his hand. And that's sort of what we have going on right now with Andrew Brown Jr. They get out the lie first, and then it makes it harder to combat. Let's take a listen to Mr. Crump's co-counsel in the Brown matter, Attorney Lassiter, as he likes to say.
Let's be clear. This was an execution. Andrew Brown was in his driveway. The sheriff truck blocked him in his driveway, so he could not exit his driveway. Andrew had his hands on his steering wheel. He was not reaching for anything. He wasn't touching anything. He wasn't throwing anything around. He had his hands firmly on the steering wheel. They run up to his vehicle, shooting. He still stood there, sat there in his vehicle with his hands on the steering wheel while being shot at. He finally decides to try to get away, and he backs out, not going towards the officers at all. There was at no time in the 20 seconds that we saw where he was threatening the officers in any kind of way. He was trying to evade being shot. So he backs out, not forward, but backs out away from the officers who's still shooting at him, yelling, "Stop it, motherfucker!" Constant obscenities being yelled at him while he's being shot at in the driveway of his home in Pasquotank County, North Carolina.
Now, if we listen to her, we think, well, why would anybody... Boy, he must be remarkably disciplined. All he did was sit still in his vehicle with his hands on the wheel and wait to get shot. And then when he was shot, he waited some more. And then finally he tried to drive away and went safe. And then they murdered him by shooting him in the back of his head. That's sort of that's just what happened. Why did they pick him to murder that day? Well, the tape clearly shows that these cops pile out of a truck. They're trying to do a high-risk warrant for this crack dealer. Mr. Dante Wright is lauded by some in the media as being a kindly father of seven, and with their profiles by his grandmother and his mother, and I think a cousin I saw, all profiled to discuss his gentleness and what a great person he was. But the truth is that he was a person who was arrested a dozen of times, probably. I saw at least three separate felony convictions on his record. There were several crimes of violence on the record. The felonies seem to all have been for drug dealing. He was a crack dealer, among other things. And I don't favor that being illegal in the first place, and certainly not a death sentence. But the idea that this was just a fellow who happened to be at the scene of where a warrant was being served or just had a warrant out for him and then got caught up in this is a big lie. He's a drug dealer who was trying to run away from the consequences of police interaction with him. And he took his chance and he lost. He pulled away into the police. And if you watch the video, you'll see it. Lassiter, who is now hooked up with Mr. Crump, they're expert at this media manipulation. And The View is, of course, not where anybody should go for their news on criminal justice matters, but millions of Americans do tune into it. And I thought this was a fascinating way. You know, they are all in on this anti-cop thing because of the way they represent these stories. This is the intro.
On April 21st, armed police arrived at Andrew Brown Jr.'s property to serve him with arrest warrants. They descended upon him with guns drawn as he sat in his car, and 44 seconds later, he was dead.
I don't know why, but I get just a chuckle, sort of the deconstruction of it. Think about what Whoopi says. Armed police arrived. Is there a police officer in America that you know that goes to work and doesn't strap a gun on their hip? Armed police. That's something. Watch any British shows. You can hear sometimes they'll shout as they go about their operation, "Armed police!" And the idea is that that's a different categorization than the regular police over there. But of course, we don't have unarmed police in the United States of America. Every cop's got a gun on their hip. That's how we do. So just framing it that way, I just thought, oh wow. And what do we learn about Mr. Brown from Ms. Lassiter on The View?
Mr. Brown was just trying to leave the scene. And you know, for arguendo purposes, if they're saying that he was a threat, which we're not saying that he was, once he was fleeing and leaving the scene, at that point, he was no longer a threat, if that's what they're trying to say. And he was shot in the back of the head, meaning he was leaving. He was away from the officers. They were all behind him. And the DA also did not mention they were firing in a school zone at 8:20 in the morning. They fired into a residence
at the property near Mr. Brown's house. So they were just firing shots when Mr. Brown was not even near them.
He just wanted to leave. That's what we learned from Ms. Lassiter. But how does that distinguish him from any felon? Of course he wanted to leave. The method with which he did so was to drive away and endanger the bodies of the police officers who were then legally entitled to shoot him. You don't have to have deadly force present to shoot somebody, even though I think you can make a colorable case, certainly that the car is deadly force, but just the risk of serious bodily injury is enough to authorize the use of deadly force. And I just think it's hilarious. This is something I've noticed with Mr. Crump and his allies and those under his tutelage. They like to throw in these external details and act like they are somehow important. Like, we see this with the Michaela Miller stabbing, where they say, oh, she's the one who called the police. And they say it over and over vehemently, as if somehow that excuses her attempted murder when the police arrive. Oh, well, she's the one who called. Well, then they should just let her murder somebody. It's hilarious. They talk about, or Ms. Lassiter discusses the police use of profanity as they were shooting Mr. Mr. Brown. Well, did Mr. Brown experience profanity in the 6+ years he was a convicted felon in prison? Did he use it? Is this really something, you know, like he's some old church lady and that somehow flustered him or made him incapable of acting? What happened was they had a warrant to raid this guy's house for being a crack dealer. When they pulled up, he just so happened to be in his car at the time. So they ran up onto the car, of course, to seize him, tell him to stop moving and show his hands and get out and submit to the arrest. Lassiter talks about how he had his hands on the wheel and nothing else was in his hands, as if that somehow mitigates this event because he wasn't holding some weapon other than the car. And it's a total lie, the presentation. It's just designed to gin up basically falsely generated outrage. Because what she could have said was, and I'm open to the possibility of this argument, that the police did not accurately perceive his actions as a threat, or should not have perceived his actions as a threat with that car. They should have gotten out of the way. They weren't entitled to stand there or somehow flee. I don't know what kind of justice she's looking for there, but what she can't say and have the veneer of forthrightness and truth is that he had nothing in his hands, as if the police had claimed that the man had a knife or a gun in his hand. They never did. It's all part of selling this lie. Now, Crump this week, it would have been Michael Brown's 25th birthday. Crump tweeted on the 20th, sadly, just days after his high school graduation, Brown was fatally shot by Ferguson police officer while his hands were raised. Hands up, don't shoot. All caps on that. A total lie. The Justice Department report published by Eric Holder, the descendant of American slave, African-American attorney general, authorized by Barack Hussein Obama, our first black president, witnessed by all the black people who are named in the report, the witnesses. He didn't have his hands up. In fact, he was assaulting and trying to beat the hell out of at least or gain control of the gun of Mr. Wilson, Officer Wilson. That's the truth about Mike Brown. All right. That's enough for Andrew Brown Jr. Talk some Bitcoin. We're going to have Andrew Moran, our favorite economist, in to talk about it. But there's just a couple details about the coin I want to discuss. Bitcoin, of course, is not an actual coin. It's a digital product. It was conceived of or first announced publicly in 2008 by this person who has an alias called Satoshi Nakamura. And we don't know who the real person is, at least not publicly has discussed who they are. But they created this computer program or computer network that would enable the production of these Bitcoins. They call it mining, is how Bitcoin is produced. I encourage you to read more about it. I don't know enough to explain it. I think in a cogent way. So I'll leave you to it to go to other sources. But basically what happens is computers solve complex math problems, and that produces a new Bitcoin into reality. It's an oversimplification to be sure, but that's what we're going to work with here. And the number of Bitcoin is limited to 21 million, which is to say there will never be more than 21 million total Bitcoin produced ever. That makes it anti-inflationary. Unlike the dollar, which I'm going to talk about with Andrew Moran, that can be, we print infinity dollars and therefore reduce the value of a dollar. Bitcoin are only going to get fewer in number once the total number is produced. So I think they said, I'm trying to remember how many years it's going to take to get to 21 million. But in any case, once that's done, the total number of Bitcoin will only ever stand pat or decrease. So that's where the store of value exists. And that's why I think it's an attractive product, in addition to the lack of central bank involvement. All right. That's enough for my my tutorial on Bitcoin. It's one of those things where I happen to know more than probably most people about it. But also when I read about it, I recognize that I'm just scratching, you know, a fingernail on the surface of what's out there. So I think it has a lot of implications, though, for liberty because of it being a financial product, a means of exchange that's completely divorced from government interference. And if you think about how much of our lives are controlled by the currency and how much influence governments have over that currency or value, you can see the implications for Bitcoin moving forward. All right, here's Mr. Moran. Are you a prince or a pauper? Well, do you have to check your Bitcoin statement to know? It's wild times out there, and here to discuss the latest in the Bitcoin market is Andrew Moran from LibertyNation.com and other fine publications, who I won't lead you to around the world. Thank you, Andrew, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
From the Great White North, Andrew is a Canadian, and we have a strong and vibrant uprising fan base in the Maritimes and Ontario, Andrew.
Yeah, we have a Scott Cassenza fan club in Toronto.
So it's been a crazy wild ride for those people who don't know. Bitcoin has gone, I think, over 30% swing. and I think the valuations last week were topping 60,000. And at one point, I saw a source were below 30,000, high 29s at some point this week. So, and that's just the latest. It's barely Thursday afternoon. They're still, the market's never closed. So you check with trepidation if you have any of this stuff, especially if you're if you're long on it like I am, and I think that you are. For full disclosure, we both own some portion of Bitcoin in some vehicle. I don't mean to be vague about it. I just mean there are index funds that can trade in it, and there's actual direct ownership. So anyway, is this all Elon Musk's fault, Andrew? Do we have are there going to be Bitcoiners with pitchforks standing outside the Tesla dealerships demanding some kind of retribution?
Well, I think he initiated a lot of the madness going on, because over the weekend before the crash happened, or the perhaps correction, however you want to describe it, somebody tweeted that Tesla Motors is going to report in its next quarterly earnings that it ditched some of its Bitcoin holdings after purchasing, I think it was $2 billion at the start of the year, and then he replied with, quote, indeed. And that created a huge firestorm of what's going on in Bitcoin right now. And then there was a huge sell-off on all the other crypto assets. And then there was silence on his part for a day. And then he went back on Twitter by saying, just to clarify, Tesla hasn't sold anything. So that was the start of it. And then it exacerbated on Monday or Tuesday when the People's Bank of China, or the Chinese Central Bank, when they imposed new regulations on Bitcoin, which then led to the crash of the entire cryptocurrency market. Now I think people are moving beyond that and looking to the next event horizon in Bitcoin prices.
Musk's history in this area is a bit interesting, because not only did he buy, I actually thought it was 1.5 billion, but you say two, I'll take your number.
It's something like that, around there.
Yeah. 2 billion in Bitcoin in Tesla. And then he tweeted, he added a Dogecoin information, which is another Bitcoin I've heard it called a meme coin, which I think is interesting, which means that it's for various reasons, it doesn't have the kind of functionality in the marketplace that Bitcoin and some of the other cryptocurrencies have. It's more of a fad, or I don't want to call it a joke. But in any case, he added that information about that to his Twitter profile. He talked about it on Saturday Night Live, and there's sort of this idea that he is going to be, you know, the champion of this Dogecoin and also Bitcoin. And then not only did he say that he wasn't going to continue, then they announced, in addition to the purchase with Tesla, that Tesla was going to accept Bitcoin as payment for vehicles. So you could transact in non-dollars, just in Bitcoin. And then he came out and said they were going to stop doing that because Bitcoin mining, which is the way that a Bitcoin comes into existence, was so environmentally deleterious because of the energy required to process a Bitcoin. Yep. So he's sort of been leading the charge and then also responsible for its destruction, it seems like, all in the span of a month.
Yeah, if you monitor his Twitter activity, which is just as entertaining as former President Donald Trump, he was complaining about how centralized it's become and how, you know, the ownership of Bitcoin is going to a handful of people, because, you know, Wall Street, after so many years of being apprehensive, they've suddenly become very interested in Bitcoin. So now they're launching these Bitcoin ETFs, they have these index funds, you know, and then there's athletes who want to be paid in Bitcoin. So as Bitcoin has become more mainstream, you're having the wealthiest of people scooping it up. So that's what Elon Musk has complained about. So now that's why he's so bullish on Dogecoin, because, you know, it's more there's more prevalence. I mean, excuse me, there's more number of Doge coins than there are Bitcoins right now. I think 100 million, 200 million, something like that. I don't know the specific numbers. But when you talk about the functionality of a Dogecoin, one of the interesting things about Dogecoin is that it facilitated micropayments. So let's say you're a YouTuber and you produce this great content. Someone on YouTube wants to contribute to you. So they were able to give you, you know, a micropayment as a tip to say, hey, what a great job you're doing. And Dogecoin, because of its volume, has less amount of transaction costs than Bitcoin. So that's why... The reason why he likes the democratization of...
But Dogecoin, they can essentially print more of it, unlike Bitcoin, yeah. Right? So let's talk about, just in terms of the political value, I think the notion... We talked... Andrew and I both appeared on Liberty Nation Radio this week, and we had a bit of a discussion there about inflation as a tax increase. When the government decides to print more money, can you say what M2 is? Can you describe that to people?
Yeah, the M2 money supply is pretty much the entire money in the United States economy. And over the last 12 months, the Federal Reserve has created about 1/4 of all U.S. dollars ever printed. So when you add that kind of money to the economy...
Well, hold on. You talk quickly, and that, I think, is a fact that most people don't have a grasp on. So every single dollar that was printed ever was a X amount a year ago, and then add 25% more printed dollars to that because of all the crazy spending that's been going on. So every single dollar is automatically worth that much less because there are so many more dollars in circulation. That's what leads to the inflation. So you own less of something. It would be like if you owned a share of Apple and there were 1 million shares, and then last year they decided to just issue another 250,000 shares and give them away. And you would say, well, I own that much less of the company, so my value is decreased. Same thing with inflation, and to the tune of 25%. Has the government ever done something so radical with the money printing?
Well, it's unprecedented, but, you know, there's been vast amounts of creation going on. You had the last financial crisis in 2008, where the Federal Reserve stepped in and added another $1 trillion to the supply. You had the dot-com bubble, you know, they added more money to the economy. So the Federal Reserve, all it's known for is printing a lot of money. But the problem with when you create all this money is that there's such an addiction to the money creation at the very top that the Federal Reserve has to keep facilitating that addiction by creating even more money. Problem with the rest of the people is that if the money funnels throughout the rest of the economy, the dollar diminishes even more. And then on a grander scheme of things, when you have a devalued US dollar or more money being added to the system, the dollar, you know, crashes in the foreign exchange markets because both investors and the government, they have less confidence in the US dollar. So everyone just, you know, gives up their greenback. So that's perhaps
we used to have a system in the United States where people could save their US dollars and they would earn interest on those savings. They could rely on it. They could retire having never played the stock market or bond market or crypto anything, mm-hmm. just using old fashioned good thrift standards to save your dollars and earn compounding interest on them. And inflation destroys all that, right?
Yeah, in a way, if you think about it, the Federal Reserve is subsidizing investments because the whole point of these near zero interest rates is to nudge consumers to go into the stock market to buy ETFs, to buy Tesla stock, to buy whatever you want in the investments world. So you know, what kind of saving when you get, you know, a fraction of a penny on, you know, $1,000 in your general savings account, which could perhaps explain why the personal savings rate in the U.S. has collapsed since the 1980s. You went from, I think it was 10-15% to around 3% before the pandemic. The pandemic changed things, and now the personal savings rate is in double digits. But there's not much of an incentive to save.
Well, there's all the free money, all that influx of free money to save, right? So that might account for it.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, there's all this the pent up savings because there's nothing to do, right? So you sit at home, watch Netflix,
and you got a government check coming in, right?
And you get the government check, which people use to put into the stock market. One of the things that happened throughout the pandemic is that every time people got a stimulus check or this thing called STIMI, which bothers me so much, people say that, you know, people put that into buying Apple stock or Disney stock, and that's what artificially prop up the stock market too, is because there was this injection of cash.
I want to talk for a second about whether or not what that is doing to the crypto markets. But before I do, I want to ask, mm-hmm. is there a certain economics, you know, and my economics education is not formal at all to the extent that I have one. It's reading a few generally free market economics books and discussing and reading discussions online about these mm-hmm. issues. So that's where I'm coming from. But is there a economics argument that says basically for, I don't mean poor people that really can't get their basic needs met, but the working poor and other like kind of lower middle class Americans, that they are generally debtors rather than lenders, okay, in terms of whether it's a mortgage or student loans or whatever. And if you're a debtor, doesn't significant inflation benefit you by making the value of your debt reduced?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And so I argue, yeah, that's a very good point. A lot of people miss that point for someone who's, you know, a novice in economics. That's a great point you made. But the United States as a whole is a debtor nation. It relies on having foreign governments buy up your debt and to keep the walls of Congress open. So that's why you have, you know, the U.S. Treasury markets pumping up $1 trillion over the last year and having foreign markets and foreign governments scoop them up. So you're correct on a fundamental level when it comes to the people, and you're correct on a fundamental level when it comes to the federal government. If I have a mortgage, a $500,000 mortgage, and there's a 50% inflation rate, not that I'm saying there's going to be a 50% inflation rate, but if that happened, then you know, you have less debt to pay back. So in the United States in the future, they're going to have a few options. They're going to have a few options of either saying, okay, you know what, we admit we can't pay the debt back that we borrow from China or we borrow from Japan, or they say, hey, you know what, we'll pay the money back, but at the same time, we have to destroy the currency by 25-50%, therefore, you know, completely eliminating their debts. And I think that's what happened in the Versailles Treaty after the First World War. The Weimar Republic, they paid back their debts, but they completely destroyed their currency at the same time.
That didn't set up any problems for the future, did it? are Bitcoin prices and crypto markets, to the extent that, you know, and I know that you're not omnipotent here, but to the extent that you look out over the universe, how much of the run-up that those markets have seen in the past year or so is driven by government payments to people for stimulus rather than their own sort of independent determination that this is a flight to value or an opportunity just to make some money if they don't even dig that deep into it?
Yeah, so I think for a lot of the smart investors who are buying Bitcoin, they're doing it just so they can avoid inflation. They want to avoid, you know, having their capital being eroded. So I think the other issue you have is the fear of missing out, or as a lot of people call it, FOMO. So, you know, they see these prognostications from the likes of Goldman Sachs or Wells Fargo or all these other Wall Street titans, and they say, yeah, Bitcoin is going to go to $250,000. So people want to get in on that action by saying, okay, I can put $5,000 into this, into a Bitcoin, and I can see it double or triple. So that's also part of the reason. So I think inflation is correct. People want to find any way to protect the value of their capital, and then the FOMO. The other day I was writing an article talking about Argentina when they had their inflationary crisis, was it 8 years ago? And they wanted to put their money into anything just to protect the capital from the inflating peso. The Argentine peso had collapsed about 25% over a few months. So people were buying up Bitcoin, people were buying up gold, people were buying up Mercedes-Benz, houses, all that stuff. So you do anything you can in an inflationary environment to protect the money in your wallet.
What is the soundest non-cryptocurrency that you can think of in the world? What central bank or issuing authority has it right or as close to right as there is?
I'm sorry, what central bank has?
In other words, let's say I had a $100 bill and I wanted to hold on to it, and I didn't want to buy a cryptocurrency with it. Should I keep it as a $100 bill? Should I buy Swiss francs with it? Should I buy yen? Should I buy what?
Yeah, well, the issue with that is that all the money is fiat, so it's not backed by anything at all. So you still have that inflationary worry. But if you want to, let's say, the most competent type of central bank, then perhaps, you know, the Bank of Canada is doing a pretty decent job. You see that in the loonie.
Sure, coming out for the home team. I expect better from you on that, Andrew.
Well, the Bank of Canada, you know, you see the loonie. The loonie is at, I think.
For people who don't know, there's a duck on the coin. Oh, the $1 coin of Canada. They call it a loonie. Yeah.
Yes, they do. So the Canadian dollar.
Or goose, right? Or is it a duck or a goose? Sorry.
The Canadian goose.
Okay. Yeah. Excuse me. I apologize. I want to retain my ability to enter and leave that country at will. So apologies.
So you have the Canadian dollars at 82 cents. So people are seeing value in the Canadian dollar, I guess, because everyone's bullish on energy and, you know, what the Bank of Canada is doing. A lot of people have been going in the euro as of late. The euro is appreciated. The Swiss franc has been the go-to safe haven currency for the last, you know, several years. And what's funny is that the Swiss National Bank, which is the central bank of Switzerland, they've been trying to prevent that from happening, because when you have an appreciating currency, your exports become more expensive, and then therefore, you know, people who want to import, you know, it's more expensive.
So that's a very interesting and sophisticated concept, but you went through it quickly. So this, I think, I learned about in Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, which is perhaps the best economics book for non-economists.
Economists, I would say.
Yeah, okay, well, there you go. But you don't need to know any sophisticated economic formulas or have the math. that I think probably aids, you know, people who do that professionally. But just talks about, you know, if a U.S. dollar, if you think about it, if you're trying to sell widgets to China and the dollar is worth a lot more than it used to be, it's harder for them to gather up the resources to then exchange for dollars to send them over. So there's less buying power foreignly, and your exports are going to suffer. So yeah, there's no free lunch either way. But I just wanted to get a sense of, like, who's doing it the best. You know, if U.S. government printing is out of control and I don't want to go to crypto for whatever, what might I do with my money if I wasn't going to go? I know precious metals are something that people are a flight to value for inflationary times sometimes, but.
Yeah, well, I see. That's probably when it comes to, you know, a free market person like myself or yourself, you know, investing in foreign currency isn't necessarily the greatest thing to do. But if you want to talk about the most competent people, I recently talked about the Bank of Russia. The Bank of Russia became one of the first major central banks to actually raise interest rates to combat inflation. And I said that perhaps Joe Biden should fire Jerome Powell and put in Keir Starella. She's the head of the Russian Central Bank. Right. Reserve, because she seems smarter than Jerome Powell. She seems smarter than Tiff Macklem. She seems smarter than Andrew Bailey, because she knows what happens in the inflationary environments. And all these central banks are trying to avoid rate hikes from going on, because they want to prop up the economic recovery even more.
So there's one topic I want to bring up that's a little bit of an inside Bitcoin topic, and it's a bone I have to pick with you for one of your countrymen. I saw the Shark Tank guy, Kevin something.
Kevin O'Leary.
What is it?
Kevin O'Leary.
Kevin O'Leary. Thank you. Okay. Talking about, and this sort of piggybacks on Elon Musk's discussion of Bitcoin being too energy dependent for its generation, and he said something I had never heard before. Mr. O'Leary discussed something called blood coin. Okay. And it was the notion that, so because of, I'll just reiterate because it's new for a lot of people, because of the way the blockchain works, where a Bitcoin's creation is sort of recorded in all these disparate servers, everybody knows when a new Bitcoin comes online and it can be publicly traced dependent. It's possible to publicly trace some Bitcoins to their users and their generators. So his notion was that if you had a Bitcoin that was successfully mined, for instance, in the People's Republic of China, that somehow would be less valuable in the marketplace for a Bitcoin that was mined perhaps on Canadian soil with like solar energy or something like that. And that's where he got the blood coin thing. And I thought it was really interesting. I thought it was for two things. Number one, I thought he was trying to position himself in the marketplace to benefit by having some sort of elevated coin that he invents, because his aren't blood coin. But I thought it was very destructive to the overall, fledgling market for Bitcoin or Bitcoin adoption as a store of value, because if people don't have to worry about, I mean, yes, there's this blood diamond thing, but not really. If you have a bar of gold or a dollar, you don't have to worry about whether Al Capone stole that dollar from somebody, or that bar of gold was I'll reference the Holocaust. You can imagine, like, it's, you know, these things can have horrible pasts depending on whose hands they pass through, but we don't judge a dollar. You get a dollar and change. Is it possible, because of the way that ledger works, that Bitcoin could have a downfall here?
Bitcoin, I think the problem with Bitcoin is that it's the first generation of its kind. Like all first generations of their kinds, they eventually, you know, feed into history or feed into the trash receptacles of the past, and there are, you know, greater successors going on. So eventually I think Bitcoin will crumble for better, superior technologies. One thing I like is Ethereum. Ethereum is constantly innovating. You know, it has its blockchain technology, its blockchain ecosystem is fantastic, whereby it welcomes innovation and it constantly upgrades, constantly updates. And Bitcoin relies just on the first generation technology. Nothing really changes in it. So I think over time, you're going to have this complete paradigm shift of the cryptocurrency market. Whether it's, you know, political reasons, as Mr. O'Leary talked about, or Mr. Wonderful, that's something to see in the future, reading the crystal ball. But the amount of, I mean, how many cryptocurrencies are there right now? There's about 3,000 cryptocurrencies going
And check your watch. There's a few more coming.
And one thing I'd like to say though about Mr. O'Leary's comments and about the whole cryptocurrency markets is that a lot of the newcomers, anyway, that are worth fraction of a penny, those are the dangerous ones that a lot of people buy into. The problem with them is that they're pumped and dumped. So the issue you have is, let's say you buy a coin that says, you know, Uprising coin.
Yes, let's do it. I want to retire.
And you buy, let's say you create a million of them, and right. So you go to some channel and you say, okay, look, everyone, if you buy these Uprising coins, we're going to pump it up, and then we're going to sell it within 10 minutes. The problem with that kind of situation, the crypto market, is that the people at the very top before it went public, they're the ones who are gonna make a lot of money. It's the people who bought into it after that pump, and then it's gonna be dumped, and they're the ones gonna be left holding the bag.
I think, a very common feature of stock markets early on. Before, I mean, that's probably why we have the SEC is because of those exact scams.
Yeah, and you're right, because this is the early stage of the whole cryptocurrency market. Cryptocurrency run for what, a decade? So a lot of the nooks and crannies are going to be ironed out, and it's going to improve over time. Like the iPhone, the first generation pales in comparison to what happens today, or your average computer or whatnot. So give it 10, 20 years and cryptocurrency is going to be transformed.
When is that date that Bitcoin's going to go away, please, so I can sell before that happens?
I'm going to say in 2031, because I'll probably be dead by then.
I tried to explain before you joined us on the show about the non-inflationary or anti or de-inflationary aspect of Bitcoin. I don't know about Ethereum in that regard. Is it similarly situated? There are only going to be 21 million Bitcoin ever produced as a function of its existence. Is there a limit with Ethereum, or how does it work?
I've never heard anything about a limit being imposed on Ether coins, because the specific one is Ether. That's how you describe the coin, not Ethereum. Ethereum is the technology behind it.
Okay, so there you go.
I don't think there's a limit on these coins. I think it's up to the creator, Boltrin. I think is the Russian guy's name is.
If he decides tomorrow to simply add 100% more of those coins into the marketplace, that's something he could do.
Probably, but I don't know the specifics behind when it comes to the money creation.
All right. Well, let's not talk from ignorance then, rather than from knowledge. Finally, before I let you go, there's a relatively very new player on the scene. I see it in the news pop up. These NFTs are non-fungible tokens. What's an NFT?
Well, NFT is the digital ownership of a piece of artwork, or you know, a shoe or an image or whatever the case. They're another form of smart contracts. Here's a real-world example. You've probably seen the meme of the girl standing in front of a burning house. That image was taken about 15 years ago. It was in the public domain. Person who took that photo, they're able to create an NFT of that meme and sell it on the market for about $90,000. So the person who owns that NFT of that meme, they're the actual ownership of that. Now,
they're not the owner of, for instance, in the United States, we have a copyright law. I can take a photo. I can have the legal rights to reproduce that photo or sell it for publication. I can sell the body of those rights to somebody else, but this has nothing to do with that, right? This is something else entirely.
Yeah. I'm trying to simplify it here. So the issue with the whole NFT right now is that it's used for, let's say, pieces of artwork or some digital creation you have. But in the future with NFTs, you're going to have an issue. You're going to have a situation where you can have smart contracts. You're going to have copyright on music. You have copyright on.
So it's sort of a proof of concept at this point rather than an actual thing. If I buy the NFT of that art, presently that gives me just the ability to say I own that art as an NFT, right? But I can't exploit it in the marketplace because I have that token, right?
Yeah, but with the issue you have with the first generation of NFTs is that if there's that meme of that girl, I can go on Google search, I can type in meme of girl, and I can hit right on my mouse, hit save as, and there you go, I have it. But it's about the evolution of the technology that's going to be fantastic. I wrote about the NFTs a couple of months ago, talking about it's going to revolutionize business because you're going to have these smart.
That's in the
computer code
pages of. Liberty. The sponsor of today's program, LibertyNation.com, your source for conservatarian news and analysis 24/7, 365. All right. Is there a way to, I just want to, if you can, as briefly as you can, summarize what an NFT is for people who, what we just said may have gone over or under, over the head or under the knees.
So an NFT stands for non-fungible token. Now, it's a digitalization of ownership of an asset, whether it's a piece of art, online real estate, whatever the case, it's digital ownership of any asset that you claim it to be.
Online real estate. Does that mean like a URL?
No. There's actual online real estate. There's it's a funny website where you have this digital earth and you buy pixels of the earth for a dollar amount or a cryptocurrency, whatever the case. And, you have the NFT for that piece of code or pixel.
Right now, so here's, I understand where the value is with Bitcoin, 100%. I understand Ethereum less, a little bit, but for Bitcoin, it is a medium of exchange with no central governing authority. The United States government, I can conduct a transaction with a guy who's in China and not go through any kind of central bank clearinghouses in China or the United States. We can deal directly with one another. And we don't have to trust one another because of the way the Bitcoin network eliminates the possibility of kind of nefarious double dealings. And so that's why I see where the value for Bitcoin really is, and that it's deflationary, or at least non-inflationary. Where is the value? Like, what does the NFT solve that, or where, you know, why we see fantastically high amounts? There's a Sotheby's or that other auction house this weekend, I think, is having a big NFT thing. What's going on? Where's the value?
Well, yeah, well, it's subjective value. So it's pretty much, you know, so if I exchange a Bitcoin for a Bitcoin, I'm exchanging for a specific amount. But if I'm buying an NFT, it's just like an auction house. It's what I'm willing to pay for it. So what's her name? Paris Hilton. She was one of the first sellers of an NFT. She sold a picture, a painting of her cat. Someone was willing to spend $12,000 to have ownership of that picture. So there's not much difference. It's just subjective value. It's an auction system. It's a bartering system. It's what people will pay for it. It's not some, you know, vast technology, a vast, you know, complication behind it. It's just what people want to pay for it.
From the country of Canada, Andrew Moran, thanks so much for joining us on this episode of The Uprising. Check out your work in libertynation.com. Andrew, in addition to his regular writings, my favorite product of his is the Swamponomics video casts that he does. And you can check those out on all our video channels. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks again to Andrew for that. All right, to wrap up, are the aliens coming? Are they here? Well, Barack Hussein Obama says they are, in a roundabout way.
When it comes to aliens, there are some things I just can't tell you on air. But what is true, and I'm actually being serious here, is that there's footage and records of objects in the skies that we don't know exactly what they are. We can't explain how they moved, their trajectory. They did not have an easily explainable pattern. And so, you know, I think that we're people still take seriously trying to investigate and figure out what that is.
That was one of the most tortured ways of saying we have no idea what the hell is
going on. Classic Obama.
Which at least is the truth. I mean, he wouldn't even say it whenever he was in the office.
That's from Rising Hat Tip to them for the clip. I don't keep up with Mr. Corden's show, but I appreciate that. And maybe they came for the Bitcoin. We'll see. We'll follow it. Talk to you next time. Thanks for joining us on this Uprising. Visit libertynation.com for original news, articles, the Rabbit Hole podcast, and our signature television series, The Conservative Five. Just go to libertynation.com on your browser, or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for watching. This program is a production of libertynation.com, conservative news where truth matters.
Who are we? We are Americans that believe in liberty. We are a project of the nonprofit, one generation away. We are patriots who apply the founding principles to the issues of today.
And they keep moving the goalposts on us.
We are educators and commentators who love America and the Constitution. Who are we? We are Liberty Nation.